We're talking to Vint Cerf, one of the founders of the internet. Vint, there seems to be a number of caveats regarding the future of the internet. And I was wondering, would you pick the top three in your opinion?
Well, the first one, of course, is the situation where we're running out of IP version 4 address space. We need to implement the IP version 6 format. The software has been largely done for most edge devices, servers, laptops, and so on. The router systems have that software, generally speaking, but the internet service providers haven't turned it on. So that's what this meeting at 60K is about, is getting that process underway before we run out of the V4 address space sometime in 2012 or possibly even a little before that. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, is, generally speaking, is security on the network. If people don't trust the applications that are running on the net for fear of somehow either becoming infected because they're on the net, that is to say their computers become infected, or somehow losing important personal information, financial information, health information, the network won't be as widely used and won't be as widely found to be a basis for improving GDP by creating new jobs and businesses. So security, reliability, and things of that kind are a second important element. There are steps being taken to improve the security of the network. I mentioned a few today in the 60K meeting. The third thing, I think, is coping with the mobility in the network. The original designs did not do a very good job of making mobile access to the network easy. We don't have time to go into all the details behind that, but that's another technical and protocol-related thing that needs to be done. So those three things, treating mobility, dealing with reliability and security, and coping with address expansion by introduction of E6 are the three top things on my list.
There seem to be some other issues. Governments seem to want to lock down the internet to a much greater extent than in the past. I'm hearing stories about China wanting to take its version of the net off the original grid. Can you talk to that for a minute?
Well, first of all, we understand that the internet has enabled communication where communication didn't exist before. It enables a kind of flexibility that didn't exist, where anyone can essentially publish what they want to say on blogs and websites and the like. People with mobiles, like the one you're using, I guess that's not a mobile, is it?
This is a
it's a recorder, okay,
yeah.
But mobiles can take pictures, do recording, and so on. So people have become their own publishers in a way. Some countries feel threatened, or the regimes in those countries feel threatened by freedom of exchange of information. Other countries are reacting to the hazards that are on the net, the kind of abuses that are undertaken, whether it's stalking or capture of personal information. And their reaction to this is, well, if everyone is forced to identify themselves, or if we filter everything that's on the network, somehow we will prevent these bad things from happening. I am not persuaded that it's possible to lock down the net in this way, but even if it were possible, it isn't clear that that's a world in which we would all want to live. It's sort of like saying that we could make a very secure society if everything everyone ever wants to do or does is known. On the other hand, that may not be a world that you want to live in. On the other hand, if we say, well, anonymity is the wave of the future, no one can know what anyone is doing, we preserve their privacy, the society might be at risk. I mean, terrorism and things of that sort come to mind. So there must be some balance in between. My sense right now is that we can and shall make changes to the network's technical architecture to improve its safety. But we also need legal agreements that cross international boundaries in order to enforce either laws to protect citizens or laws to improve our ability to conduct electronic commerce. And example, digital signatures are now technically possible. You can sign a digital document. The problem is, does every administration and every legal system give the same weight to a digital signature? And the answer is no. In some cases, the topic isn't even addressed. We need to work on a multilateral way, in a multilateral way, in order to make the online business community more friendly to operation. In particular, we have agreements with each other, and the disputes cross international boundaries. We need legal structures that will allow us to resolve those problems.
Do you think that the current negotiations for the anti-counterfeiting trade agreements could be a benchmark for that?
It's possible. My sense right now is that a lot of trade and commerce is conducted on the Internet. And to the extent that those transactions are inadequately protected, either with regard to privacy or with regard to recourse in the event of an unsatisfactory outcome, unless we are able to protect those transactions, then they will be less popular and less an avenue for improved total GDP growth. So I am at least persuaded that more of the governments of the world are recognizing the importance of this. I would say, however, we're some distance from knowing what kinds of legal structures ought to be adopted. There's a tendency in some quarters to look at internet security as if it were a kind of national crisis, or to treat problems on the internet in that area as if it were a form of warfare. And I think that that metaphor is probably overdrawn and in some ways dangerous to adopt, because adopting the weapons of war in this online environment may turn out to be the wrong choice. To give you a small example, when an attack is launched in the cyberspace environment, it isn't always clear where it came from. Or it comes from the machines that are owned by the general population, whose machines have been corrupted by viruses or worms or Trojan horses. They don't even know their machines are being used for this purpose, and the users of those machines, we call them the botnet generals, don't want it to be apparent that the machines have been compromised, because they'd like to keep that asset in operation. They don't want to destroy the internet either. They want it to keep going because they have a business that they're building around it. So the problem, of course, is that if you're the target of an attack of some kind, whether it's spam or denial of service or something, it would appear that the various attack vectors are coming from the general public. Now, if you chose the typical warfare stance, you would launch a counterattack. You'd be attacking the assets of the general public or the private sector. And there might be a lot of collateral damage that does not have a good outcome. It might have a very direct impact on the rest of the economy. Attribution of the origin of some of these attacks is a very difficult problem. This doesn't mean there shouldn't be a response, but it does mean we should be very careful about the framework in which we try to cope with this problem. The other worry I have about the cyber warfare notion is that you might choose to use weapons other than cyberspace-oriented ones in order to respond. You decide to go do physical damage. And once again, failure to get the correct attribution could lead to a very severe problem, attacking the wrong country, for example. I think there are other metaphors that would be helpful to think through. Public health would be an example. When the computer gets sick and it's possibly contagious, you confine it and try to vaccinate it against further problems. Or cyber fire department notion, where you're under attack and you need the fire department to come and help put out the cyber fire. Or maybe even the police department, which you normally don't call unless you believe a law has been broken, or you are your house is being broken into, or you are under attack. You call the law enforcement people. We need cyber equivalents of those sorts of things. This is still a fairly new environment. The internet has not been in public operation until about 1994, which is about 16 years. It's not very much time in which to understand what societal and administrative and jurisdictional response we should have to the problems that we're encountering.
The UK government recently made cyber terrorism, cyber attacks a tier one national threat. Is that helpful in thinking about these issues?
I'm sorry, ask the question one more time.
The UK government recently rated cyber-based attacks
as a
tier one national threat.
I see.
Is that helpful?
I think that's a very odd formulation of the problem, because unless the internet is so fundamental to the economy already, it's hard to argue that that problem space is rates number one.
Well, Google's just said it's worth 7.5% of the economy.
Yes,
but that's significant.
That is significant, but it is not the other 92.5%. There are lots of other problems in the business world, fraud and the like, which is perpetrated through other means, whether it's the telephone system, postal service, and face-to-face transactions. But nonetheless, I don't want to minimize the problem space. It is well worth investing in technical means to defend against some of these problems. But they will not be solved solely by technical means. We also need to improve our ability to detect the problem after the fact. So that means audit trails and things of that kind. Stronger authentication of the parties in a transaction would also help. This is sometimes misunderstood as saying that we should abandon the ability to use the network in an anonymous way. I don't take that view. What I do believe, however, is that if you, as a party in a transaction, wish to know who the other parties are, you should have the wherewithal to demand strong authentication of identity. If they refuse, you don't have to conduct the transaction. So you should have that tool available to you. But it shouldn't be required that you must fully identify yourself before you can even use the network.
What can companies and consumers do to protect themselves better today?
Well, they can certainly put pressure, if they can, on the parties who supply them with their hardware and software to say that they're expecting a better quality of system than they're getting. I can imagine that there may be some consideration of liability associated with software problems. This is a very difficult territory to draw boundaries around. As a former programmer, I know that there is no piece of software that doesn't have a bug. You know, they all have bugs. You just haven't found them all yet. And some of them are honest mistakes. However, there are, for example, engineers that are licensed, and sometimes you don't allow projects to proceed without having a licensed engineer in charge. Building a bridge, for example, there are liabilities associated with using poor materials in construction or having a poorly designed system. Whether we reach that point in the software world, I don't know. There are always the potential unintended consequences of that sort of thing, especially where you confuse a reasonable and honest error as opposed to something that was deliberate. Nonetheless, if you make a mistake and the building collapses and people are killed, I suppose there are issues that still have to be dealt with. So I think that practices along these lines might be considered. Apart from that, I think that most companies who are using the internet as a tool, Google being one of them, recognize that trust is very important, that security and safety and privacy are critical. If your customer base goes away, you don't have the business anymore. We know that. Others recognize that. So there's strong motivation to do a better job of those various protections. I think pressure still needs to show up in the academic community to get research done to improve the basic ideas behind operating systems and browsers and the like. And maybe we need to think a little bit more about the business climate and the legal structure that imbues people with a sense of responsibility for doing a better job of protecting us in this environment.
So how can we get the politicians a bit more excited about this?
Well, I think if they understand the connection between the internet and the GDP in particular, and that it is an avenue for exporting talent without losing them from the country, or drawing business into the country without physically having to go there, that they should have a certain amount of desire to make sure this platform continues to grow. it's an enormous opportunity for any country that has the wherewithal to create well-trained staff, engineers, scientists, software programmers, businessmen, who are eager to use the net to reach out to a global environment. If you have a fairly modest, relative to the rest of the world, modest total turnover in the country, then the only way to grow is to go after business that's outside the domestic boundary. There are a lot of countries that are in that position where they have very well-trained people, but they have the capacity to serve a broader audience than the purely domestic one. So Google, as an example, clearly has expanded its operation well outside of U.S. borders. It's relied very heavily on investment in capital goods, data centers and the like, to amplify the work of its engineers. The same sort of theory could apply here in the U.K.
Vince Cerf, thank you very much for your time.
It's a real pleasure.